Yep, okay. All right, so very like to thank the organizers for inviting me. It's been a very interesting meeting so far. I certainly don't speak to this audience very often. I think it's the first time I've met with so many mathematicians and also people from quantum information. The title, as you can see, is a little bit more general than the title originally posted. It's also, there's a subtext. I mean, I like to think of our work as really just playing around and having fun with wave functions. I'm in the chemistry department, as you can see, but chemistry is, of course, founded in, at least the theory of chemistry is founded in quantum mechanics, and so we have to think about wave functions quite a lot. I should point out this work is done with many people and some of my collaborators and my group. Since I'm not sure what audience I'm speaking to, I think I should start off by defining what quantum chemistry is. We start with the Schrödinger equation, which is just an eigenvalue problem where H is some operator and the eigenvectors are called psi, conventionally. That's the wave function, and E is the eigenvalue, and this has the meaning of the energy of the system. The operator H is just a differential operator. Physically, it's the operator which describes what the electrons are doing. Chemistry is primarily about electrons. And it's a differential operator summed over the sum extent over all the electrons, which may be some number from range from 1 for the hydrogen atom to hundreds of thousands when you're looking at a protein molecule. And it has this second derivative operator, this function here, which we call external potential, is just some reasonable-looking function. And then a Coulomb repulsion, this is 1 over the coordinates between the electrons. And we look for the solutions of this problem. Now, formally, the eigenvector, the eigenfunction, written in a coordinate representation, is just a high-dimensional function of the positions of all the particles. Each particle is in three-dimensional space, so that's why this is in bold. And we solve the eigenvalue problem subject to a boundary condition. There's various boundary conditions, but of course, the one most relevant to this conference is that the wave function is a function that's anti-symmetric, which simply means when I interchange the particles, I get a minus sign. Now, of course, this is because they're electrons. If we're looking at some other kinds of particles, we would get a different sign. We'd get a positive sign, or perhaps even a phase. Okay. Now, when we think about high-dimensional wave functions, it's actually not always so convenient to work in this formulation. I mean, this is what we call first quantization, but of course, it's more convenient to work in what's called second quantization. So let me just briefly explain what second quantization is. Probably many of you, certainly all the physicists who have seen this. We first discretize a problem, so you're not really working in the continuous space. So you select a one-particle basis, and you think of expanding your wave function in this tensor product of space of the one-particle basis. So let me write down a one particle basis. It's a discretization with k functions. And then, of course, if we think about product functions, which describe these many electron objects, which are anti-symmetric, the very simple product function is just to take the determinant of some function selected from this one particle basis. So if I have a problem where I have n electrons, then I would pick as a basis function to expand my wave function, I'd pick n out of these basis functions, and I'd make a determinant out of this. And this is what one calls a Slater determinant. And then the space of all the Slater determinants is then sufficient to span the entire anti-symmetric space. Okay. Now, this is still in first quantized form. Typically, we label the determinant, though, in a slightly different way, which is the occupation number representation. So rather than saying I've got determinant 3, 5, 6, and 10, orbitals 3, 5, 6, and 10 in my determinant, one can write down a string like this to write down the occupancies. So we say, well, because the third basis function is in the determinant, I write a 1 there, and the fifth one is in there, so I write a 1 there. Again, so this is the occupation number representation. And this is the representation that is essentially what we call second quantization. And so we can, more generally, I can write down any basis vector for this high-dimensional Hilbert space and label it by the occupancies, which are 0 or 1. And then you can move around in this space using what are called creation destruction operators, and these things just change the occupancies. The creation one obviously changes 0 to 1, and the destruction changes the 1 to a 0. And then it's convenient to choose these things. It's not entirely necessary, but it's convenient to choose them to have some commutation relations like this for fermions. Okay, so I think that defines the mathematical problem of quantum chemistry. Now let's see some of the different physical realizations. The quantum chemistry really occurs in various limits. So different physical problems can be classified into different kinds. And we usually classify them in terms of how important the correlations between the electrons are. So in other words, how linked the motions of the electrons are in the problem. And so one limit is to assume that the motion of the electrons is really kind of independent, and that's a weakly correlated limit. And in that case, the structure of the eigenfunctions, or the Schrödinger equation, okay, the wave function, really has a simple form where it's primarily dominated by a single determinant, okay, so one single choice of occupancies, and that's qualitatively correct, and then there's a tiny correction. Okay, and so we call this a weakly correlated limit. So this what we call the correlation, which is the all-important thing, is just a small correction. Now, it's quite easy to determine what this single occupancy is. That's what's called Hartree-Fock theory. At least it's quite kind of easy in practice. There are also many ways to determine what this correction is. And what quantum chemistry has been engaged in for the last 30 or 40 years has been to try and find very efficient ways to determine this correction very accurately. And so there are many ways to do that. You can use perturbation theory. If you imagine it's a small correction, that seems very natural, small perturbation. You can do what's called configuration interaction. You can do coupled cluster theory. Many, many different techniques. And they're all, by now, very powerful and very successful. So it's possible now to obtain extremely high accuracy if the physical problem you're interested in is in this limit. So you can obtain an accuracy which is competitive with the experiment, or certainly something which can predict experiment to the same precision that experiment can measure the quantity. And it's also possible to treat very large problems, thousands of atoms, and so on and so forth, in this limit. Now, of course, this is a kind of a simple limit, because we're saying from the outset, let's restrict ourselves to cases where the final answer is dominated by a single occupancy, okay, a single determinant. The other limit is probably the more interesting one, especially these days, and that's the strongly correlated limit, where we can't think of this correction as being small. In this case, really, you think of your wave function as having to be expanded over many, many of these n particle basis states, many of these determinants, and all of them have very large coefficients. You can't pick one to be larger necessarily than the other. So this correction here is no longer small, and it may involve a very, very large expansion, perhaps even an expansion that's factorially large in the number of electrons. So it kind of grows very rapidly as your problem size increases. Now, if you ask, well, where does this happen in chemistry? I've had some interesting discussions at this conference. I thought I should explain this a little bit. The easiest way to construct such a situation is when there's some kind of degeneracy in the kind of natural one-particle basis states. And this occurs in the atomic limit. So let me give a simple example. If I take a molecule like H2, okay, this is, H is the first atom of the periodic table, okay, hydrogen, okay. H2 is, of course, sort of the first molecule in the molecular periodic table, so to speak. And the natural basis states for this problem are one-particle basis functions. When it's in the bonding region, now, there are these one-particle basis functions, which we call molecular orbitals. And at ordinary chemical conditions, these are very widely separated in energy. So one is very low in energy, one's very high in energy. And so you kind of say, well, if I'm looking for the ground state, it's very natural as a first approximation to just occupy this state here. So the configuration where this one is occupied is, of course, very high in energy, okay, to first approximation. Now, when you pull apart the hydrogen molecule, and of course, pulling apart bonds is what chemistry is about. Right? If you never broke any bonds, everything was stuck together, there'd be no reactions. Then these natural basis functions, these orbitals, become very close together. And then in that case, you no longer have a case where you can really say, I should fill this one or I should fill this one. Really, the wave function is some combination of all the possible occupancies of these orbitals. And so we no longer have a single determinant as the dominant contribution to the wave function. Now, this is a very simple problem. H2 is a very small molecule. There are only kind of two basis functions that we need to think about. But when we go to some system like this, it's very perhaps a little bit artificial looking, and hydrogens all arranged in a square, and then we think about, what kind of are the orbitals degenerate? You see, you'll have many, many degeneracies between your one particle basis states at this stretch geometry, and you have to consider all the different occupancies. Your wave function is made up of all the possible determinantal states. And if this molecule, to the chemist in the audience, looks a little bit artificial, one can construct a realistic example just by replacing those hydrogen atoms by transition metal atoms. And these, of course, have d orbitals. The d orbitals do not overlap very well, and so the corresponding molecular orbitals are always nearly degenerate in the d space. Okay, so to see some real-world examples where you have strong correlation in quantum chemistry, from a physical perspective, whenever your single particle spacing, the spacing of these natural basis functions of molecular orbitals, is relatively small and comparable to the Coulomb energy between the electrons, then you're in the strongly correlated limit. And this occurs always when you have poor atomic overlap. So when your atoms are relatively far apart, they don't split the single particle levels very much, and so that occurs in metals, which have d orbitals, and when you're doing making or breaking of bonds. And so you can see that's what catalysis is about. Catalysis is about metals making or breaking bonds. The analog in condensed matter is, of course, all the strange phenomena that you see in transition metal-based materials, like transition metal oxides, like the cuprates or the iron nictides, which display high temperature superconductivity. You also see this in excited states of molecules, that if you shine a laser at a molecule, okay, it goes from its ground state into some excited state. In the excited part of the spectrum, the one particle levels are relatively close together, and so one gets more of this strong correlation. And excited states often also occur in rather low-dimensional molecules, polymers and so on and so forth, and there's a lot of strong correlation in these systems, which really, these kinds of these kind of molecules, we call them conjugated molecules, are what kind of form the basis of how nature interacts with light. Okay, so pigments that we have or plants have or so on, they're all of this form. Okay, now let me just introduce a little bit of terminology. I'm actually going to just use one term from this slide, but I'll just show it in general. So I said that the strongly correlated limit occurs when the natural basis functions, these molecular orbitals, one particle levels, are nearly degenerate. Now, in a molecule, you actually have various scales. So there'll be some which are nearly degenerate, some which are very low in energy, and some which are very high in energy. I'm going to be concerned only with what is called the active space, that's the term I wanted to introduce, which we can think of for this talk as this near degenerate space of one particle levels. And in this active space, we have the situation that the wave function in this space cannot be simply written as primarily based on a single occupancy of the levels. Instead, we have to consider possibly all possible occupancies. And that's a factorially hard problem. If I take n electrons and distribute them across m orbitals and think of all the possible ways I can do that, that's a factorial problem. And you can see here, if I take 16 electrons, distribute them in 16 orbitals, those of you not so familiar with electrons, the electrons come in two flavors, so there isn't just one way to do this. There can be up flavor of electrons and a down flavor of electrons. So there's really 16 and 32. Then there are 10 to the 8 ways to do that, which you can do on a computer. That's 100 million things that you have to think about. It's not so hard. But if you were to increase the problem size just by a factor of 6, then of course the exponent is increased by a factor of roughly of 6, so to speak. Okay. So before proceeding, one has to, before banging your head against the problem, you always have to think, well, is the problem going to be solvable? Okay, if you can easily see that it must be impossible, then you shouldn't bother. There's one aspect which makes it look very difficult, and that's where we say, well, if I can't pick a single occupancy or a single reference for my wave function, I really have to consider everything and there's going to be a factorial number of them, then that looks like it's a very difficult problem. And from this abstract perspective, it's basically, from a computational perspective, this is what we call impossible. But on the other hand, if you actually think about how chemistry works, okay, if you take any molecule and people think about doing chemistry on it, they don't have to worry about, when you do chemistry on an atom, say here, they don't really have to worry so much about what's going on the other side of the molecule. It may be nearby, but not, you know, 1,000 atoms away. Okay, so this implies that in all the systems that are physical interest or chemical interest, there is some locality principle at play. Okay, the phenomenon that we wish to study must have some principle of locality associated with them. So even though on a mathematical level there seems to be a near degeneracy which tells us that we have to, that all the determinants are important in the expansion of our wave function, we can perhaps take advantage of the principle of locality. That means that although in this very giant expansion we have all these expansion coefficients which are significant, the coefficients have to have some structure to them. They must all be interrelated in a way which preserves the principle of locality. And so from this perspective, then the question of how do you treat strong correlation in quantum chemistry is simply the one of how do I express locality in my expansion across this giant space in an algorithm which is a polynomial time algorithm rather than a factorial time algorithm, hopefully a polynomial which is of rather low order. Okay, so I'm now going to explain what is essentially a solution of this problem for an ideal case, in the case where you have a truly one-dimensional molecule, so to speak, then this is a perfect embodiment of this locality principle. And this is the density matrix renormalization group, which was introduced by Stephen White 17 years ago. Okay, so let's write down what we're trying to approximate is this wave function, this very high-dimensional object, and I'm going to expand it in determinants, which I've written in this occupation number form, and of course associated with each of those determinants is a set of expansion coefficients, and there are lots and lots of them, and I have to sum over all the determinants, which is the same as summing over all the possible occupancies. Now, just to emphasize, this is a giant object. Okay, it has many, many entries in this tensor with many, many entries. And we want to write down a way of approximating this object where we don't just assume some bits are zero. Okay, you don't want to throw anything away, but you want to structure the coefficients so it's very simple to approximate. So the simplest way to do it is just to separate the variables, and you can write it like this in terms of separation of variables. Okay, if this really factorized, then I could write it as a product of these vectors, and now the amount of information is clearly reduced, right? Each vector has only a few entries, so instead of an exponential amount of information, I now just have a linear amount of information. Now, and we also satisfy a criterion that really all the coefficients, we're not saying any of them are zero, we're just saying they have a product form. Now, of course, this is a rather bad approximation. We don't usually, I mean, if everything just factorized, it'd be, wouldn't have a job. So we have to make this a little bit more flexible. And so we can make it more flexible by making each of these individual decomposed objects a little bit more flexible, and you can do that by just adding indices. Okay, these indices don't occur in the final thing we want to approximate, so we have to sum over all these so-called auxiliary indices. Now, if I look at this object now, it's no longer a vector. I've decomposed this tensor not into a simple outer product of vectors. I've now decomposed it into some contraction of tensorial type quantities. And these auxiliary indices, they are associated with a typical dimension, and I'm going to call that dimension m. Okay, so each of these objects now is of dimension 4 by m by m. But if you count the number of variational parameters, it's just 4 m squared times the total number of objects, so it's 4 m squared times k, and that's generally much smaller than 4 to the k for any reasonable m. Okay, and this is, in fact, the DMRG wave function, or DMRG ansatz, also called the matrix product state. I will typically call this the DMRG wave function with so-called M states, which is a sort of historical terminology. You can see you can make m bigger and bigger, and eventually this decomposition will become exact. Now, how is locality, how is the principle of locality embodied in this ansatz? Ansatz is just an approximation to the wave function. Well, I decompose this high-dimensional tensor in this funny structured form, but you see these funny indices, these auxiliary indices that they introduced, they are connected in a certain special way. So I introduced an auxiliary index I called I1, but I repeated I1 on the next object. And then I summed over it. And what this does physically is it correlates the degrees of freedom associated with these basis functions. Okay, so I introduced correlation there. And then these ones introduce correlations there and there and there and there. Okay, so if local correlations are sort of perfectly expressed by this wave function, even though I'm only directly correlating the first and the second degrees of freedom and the second and third degrees of freedom, by virtue of the fact that if 1 and 2 are coupled and 2 and 3 are coupled, then 1 and 3 are also coupled. Okay, so correlations don't just die off in a very short range manner. So DMRG, if we physically consider these degrees of freedom to be spatially localized, which is one of the things we sometimes do in chemistry, then this wave function expresses a spatial locality that is important in all the physical phenomena that we study. If instead we choose a different kind of basis function, one which is, say, localized in the energy domain, which is also very common in chemistry, then it expresses a kind of locality of correlations across energies. Yes, go on.
Is there some pretend physical interpretation of what M is? Or
yes, M is a measure of...
How big it should be.
Well, M is kind of a measure of how non-local the phenomenon is. So if M is very small, then what you're doing is extremely local. You do something on one degree of freedom, everything else doesn't care. If you make M bigger and bigger, then you allow couplings, you allow what you do at one place to affect things further and further away. Now, you can't directly tell from a problem usually how big M should be to be right, so you kind of do a calculation with bigger and bigger M until sort of quantities converge, and then you can say, okay, well then, we've got the right M for the problem. Of course, we hope M doesn't have to be so big. Now, the essential thing, of course, about this ansatz is that the locality is expressed in this very sequential way, in this very one-dimensional way. Okay? And that's both the strength and the weakness of the wave function. Now, when you see the word, I call this a density matrix renormalization group, okay? And there are two questions you can then ask and say, why density matrix and then why renormalization group? Yeah, I'm only going to talk about why renormalization group because I think Frank will say why density matrix. So why renormalization group? So for those of you, I'm just going to assume that you've seen some RG before. If the normal RG description of a problem is you say, I've got a big problem, but let's say I've kind of solved or obtained some description of a small part of it, and I want to extend the description of that small part to a larger part without things becoming too complicated. Okay. So let's assume that, so I'm going to extend my description of a small part to another bit, and then thereby obtain a description of a larger chunk, but without things getting too complicated. That's a very informal way of saying what RG is about. So in the quantum problem, okay, the description of a bit of something is associated with having a set of states to describe it. And if I'm going to add another bit, this third orbital, the third degree of freedom, that has had some states associated with it. And then, of course, to obtain description of the two systems jointly, then I have to consider the tensor product space. Now, the tensor product space is, of course, more complicated. It's bigger in dimension, at least, than the original spaces individually. So I have to reduce that complexity, otherwise things get out of hand. And so you do a projection onto a smaller space from the tensor product space. So that's a sort of mathematical structure of RG. Now, this projection can be associated with an operator, which I'm going to call A hat. Okay, it's just a linear projection from this space down to there, sometimes called a decimation. And this operator, of course, has matrix elements. I mean, it can be represented in the basis, and it acts on this space and this space. So I'm going to write its matrix elements in this funny way, but you can see here it's got indices which are in the first space and indices which are in the second space, and then some scalar associated with that. And if you look at the structure of the DMRG wave function, these matrix elements are exactly the things which are appearing as the variational parameters in the state. Okay, so you see that there. Okay, so if you're familiar a little bit with the history of the RG, then what people used to do, I mean, what Wilson introduced, was they introduced some kind of physical insight to construct this projection. And then what you have in the DMRG is you say, well, okay, well, maybe for some problems I don't have the physical insight, at least that's so for me, and then you just say, well, let's just put them into a variational form, and then you can actually optimize them, and so you can get the optimal RG transformation, so to speak. Now these quantities here, when you do a partial trace of them, they construct a kind of density matrix, which is very interesting, and that's why it's called DMRG, but I won't talk about that. Okay, so now you can do all this in chemistry. I mean, I'm a quantum chemist, and this is what we've been. Some section of our work has been concerned with this for a number of years now. Chemistry is concerned with the Hamiltonian, which, when I write in terms of creation and destruction operators, looked a bit complicated compared to normal Hamiltonians that people used to study with these kinds of techniques. To give you some idea of the typical problem sizes, each of these indices here has, for things we're interested, some range from maybe it might be 30 dimensional, it might be 100 dimensional. So here you have 100 by 100 by 100 by 100, so it's quite big. To give you an idea, I won't go into any of the details of how we do this. I mean, it's just work. But to give you an idea of what one does, for typical chemical problems, the variational parameters associated with these auxiliary indices here, each one, they may range from about 1,000 to maybe 10,000 in a very large calculation. and the number of these individual tensors, depending on the problem you're interested in, may range from maybe 30 to more than 100. Okay, now, just to give you an example of what a calculation looks like in terms of the results, this is done by my former postdoc. This is chromium-2. This is a molecule which is a very simple molecule, okay, but it's kind of very complicated because it has a lot of these funny d electrons which are doing difficult things. And here is a giant DMRG calculation, and you get the energy out, you can get other things out, but if you look at the energy, you increase the flexibility, the sizes of these tensors, and you can see the energy converge down to the beyond the third decimal place. In terms of units in physics, okay, the third decimal place is KT, and that's why it's important for chemistry. Okay, this 1 millihartree is KT. And then we're satisfied because we've got an answer at chemical accuracy. If you look at all these other methods, now in chemistry, we have a lot of acronyms, but the reason why is because quantum chemistry is widely applied by non-specialists. So you have to be able to specify what you're doing extremely compactly. You don't have all these special details that everyone needs to know. So you want some user to be able to say, okay, I did a CCSDTQ basically calculation. Okay, so that's why we have all these long acronyms. And you can see these are all very far off from chemical accuracy. I mean, this is off by something which is would normally be considered a very good method. It's off by 40 millihartrees. That's about 2 eV, but it's tens of thousands of Kelvin. The other thing which some of you may wonder who are not chemists is why does it look like we're always concerned about 10 to the minus concerned about this third digit when the answer is so big, and that's it's kind of misleading because most of this giant number here is really a constant that's just added on more or less to the calculation. Okay, it's the energy of the electrons that are very close to the nucleus. And they have, 2,000, and they have an energy of 2,000, but they don't do anything. They just sit next to nucleus. They're not on the outside of the molecule. They never, ever do anything interesting. The interesting bit is in a very small part of the energy, which is of order 1. And then, of course, you're not interested in the total. You're not just interested in the energy of the problem. You want to say, what happens when I do something to a molecule? How does that order 1 thing change? And that's why you need, and on the scale of KT, and that's why you're interested in the third decimal place. Yes.
So CT and T seem
to be doing really well as well. Yes. That's another thing that we developed, but we won't talk about that here.
So is there an advantage of using DMRG over that?
Well, in this case, it does particularly well, but in other cases, there is an advantage to DMRG calculations. But usually, we actually combine the two techniques. We actually do a wave function, which is a hybrid of these two, but I'm not going to talk about that here. Okay. Yes, this energy is non-variational. It's second-order perturbation theory, and it goes below the true energy. There's no upper bound. So, yeah. Okay. So in this system, it's known to be too low. Okay. So I won't give you any other examples. I gave that because that's a really big calculation. You just see what. We can look at lots of chemical problems. We look at these sort of graphene strips, and you can look at various things there. Magnetism in organic molecules, light harvesting in plants. We can look at excited states. Transition metal chemistry is where all the interesting strongly correlated behavior comes from, really. And we're also looking at bioluminescence. So there are all these different applications that one can imagine doing. And we're not the only group that does DMRG in quantum chemistry. There are others around the world too. Okay, now. How much time do you have? I didn't have a clock.
12 minutes.
12 minutes. Okay. So, I promised you to have some fun with wave functions, so let's have some more fun with wave functions. That was the first bit of fun. The real question, of course, the DMRG works pretty well in quantum chemistry, but it has a fatal flaw, and that's that the locality principle is really encoded in this very one-dimensional way. And this is ideal in some cases for a very long molecule. Now, of course, you can still use it in other cases. It's no longer ideal, but it kind of works. But what you really want is an ansatz which encodes locality in a more general way. Okay, so really, the real question is, can we encode locality with arbitrary connectivity? What's the mathematical structure associated with that? And so we're very excited because we thought of something that we called correlated product states. We submitted a paper on this. But as is probably the case when perhaps an idea is, the time has come, then we're not the only people who thought of this. So in fact, Mezzacarpo and some others, Norbert Schuch is in the audience, sometime before us, in fact, considered themselves states called entangled Plaquette states. And if you look at the structure of these states, they have the same form as a correlated product state. It actually goes back a bit further. When I gave this paper some time ago to a colleague to read, he pointed out that actually all the work had been anticipated in a 20-year-old paper by David Hughes and Elsa. The funny thing about this paper is it has hundreds of citations, but people only ever cite it for the result of the calculation that they did, which is on the frustrated triangular Heisenberg lattice. And they never think about the actual how they got the result. Because I think in those days, in particular in this community, sort of trying to do numerical simulations was not really so in vogue. So one might say that this paper was ahead of its time. Okay. So anyway, the name, whatever you call it, is not so important. What's more important is the structure of the state. So so if we look at the DMRG, it has this sequential encoding of correlations like this. And the natural way to generalize it is to say, okay, I introduce these auxiliary indices to express this locality in the sequential way. Well, I want to express the locality in a more general way, so why not just add some more indices? Okay? So you can do that, and of course you no longer have some linear connection, you then have some network, and so one can call this a tensor network state. And Nishino probably was the first to think about things of this form, but the idea was really pushed forward by Frank, who's in the audience, and sort of there are some related developments by Xiao Gang. This sort of mathematical structure also occurs in other areas, of physics. But what does a tensor network look like? Well, it's from a mathematical perspective, we're just looking at a very high-dimensional approximation, a high-dimensional function, and we're trying to do an approximation to it. And I'm going to write it as something with like this, to where all these things are all connected together. Okay, now it looks very, very complicated, but each of these objects that I have here in the middle is a tensor, okay, with these auxiliary indices, and then you have to contract them across all these bonds. Okay, all right, it's very simple. or well, looks bad, doesn't it? So now this state is clearly has the right amount of information, and Frank and others have done really beautiful work with and including calculations with this kind of state. So it's very nice, but it clearly doesn't look as simple as the matrix product state or the DMRG wave function, which I showed before. So the proliferation of all these additional auxiliary indices, if you want to calculate things exactly without approximation, engenders exponential complexity. And you could get around that with approximations, but you might say, well, is there another way to think about the problem? So what motivated us was to say, well, why don't we just not have any of these auxiliary indices? Let's build the correlations in directly. Okay, so if I just want to correlate the first site and the second site, let me just write down a variational object associated with the correlations between the first and second site, one associated with the second and third, and so on and so forth, and then just multiply all of them together. And I don't need auxiliary indices in that case. Okay, so the wave function then has this mathematical form. And there you see there's no summation over these funny i's. Now, the nice thing about this is it's very easy to generalize to any connectivity. So in higher dimensions, we would say, okay, let me just put things like this. Okay, I'm just going to connect them all together. And you just take a product over all the variational objects associated with all the correlations. And this is why we call a correlator product state. And this one, of course, would be the nearest neighbor correlator product state involving two sites. You can make ones which are not nearest neighbor, which involve long-range things or which involve giant batches of things, plaquettes are squares of things, and so on and so forth. Now, how does it work? Well, we carried out some calculations on the Heisenberg model, and Norbert also did some, but I'll show my results. The Heisenberg model is a model of magnetism, and this is the these are the results that we had. We used these 2x2, so these square plaquettes. We used some other ones, but I'm only showing. I don't have too many numbers in this table. So these small plaquettes, these are the total energies. This is essentially exact energies. And these are the errors that we get. This is with open boundary conditions. And you can see we get errors which are for this model, they're okay. Yeah, they're not too bad. For those of you familiar with wave functions, if you look at the resonating valence bond state where you allow all the coefficients of the different dimers to vary, okay, then in this case you have 59 of those coefficients and you get an error of 4%, and here I think we have 60 or something like that, and we get a better error. Okay, so it's not so bad and not so bad. But the important thing is that I should also point out that if you look at Norbert's work, they carry this work out for larger plaquettes and they get smaller errors as well. So the important thing though is if you were to use the DMRG, this is a model of spins on a two-dimensional lattice. Okay, it doesn't have one-dimensional locality. So if you were to preserve the accuracy, the percentage error, while increasing the width of the problem, you'd have to increase your work, increase your computational effort exponentially with the width for fixed accuracy. And of course, here this is just increasing linearly, so it's got the correct behavior by construction. Okay, now let's look at a perhaps more interesting problem. This is a fermion problem. So this is the Hubbard model without spins. The Hamiltonian is written here, and here are some results on a 36-site lattice with periodic boundary conditions. Now, here I again compare the correlator product state with DMRG calculations, which are supposed to be ideal for this problem. They are pretty much ideal. Now, to directly compare them, you have to count the computational effort you're putting into one calculation with the computational effort you're putting into the other. And one way to count that is how many variational parameters you have in each wave function. So if I take a correlated product state, which has 96 degrees of freedom, a DMRG state with 176 degrees of freedom, the correlated product state is certainly worse. But if I take a correlated product state with a comparable number of degrees of freedom, it does better. Okay, so for the same number of degrees of freedom as the DMRG, which is considered ideal in this situation, we obtain results which are just as good, which says this is, in fact, a very good variational state. You can do it for open boundary conditions as well. You get the same thing. So the correlator product state is competitive with the DMRG with the same number of variational parameters, even for the problem of fermions. I put fermions in brackets, in quotes, because this is in 1D. And the accuracy is maintained as I change the interaction strength as well. Okay. If you read our paper, we talk a lot about the relationship between the correlated product states and other kinds of wave functions, but it looks a little bit like this. Okay, so what correlated product states and time Plaquette states or Hughes as wave functions, we're going to draw a set like this. If we now ask, what intersection of this set do you have with other kinds of wave functions? So I have to be a little bit careful about this. So correlated product states are complete bases, so you can represent any wave function. And there are other wave functions which form a complete basis. So in the limit that you had all the computer time that you wanted, then you could reach this complete basis set limit. Every such set is equivalent. But if you just had sort of polynomial computer time, then what is the intersection of the sets? Then it's like this. The correlated product states have some subset which are representable efficiently as matrix product states and tensor product states, but they're not subsets of each other. Now, correlated product states are actually a real subset of a very general kind of our resonating valence bond state, but the actual resonating valence bond states which have been used in calculations, so it has only been a subset which is completely non-intersecting with the correlated product state subset. So no one has ever considered this more general form. And then finally, for those who are quantum chemists and couple cluster, actually this should intersect a little bit with there. It's really kind of in a different space altogether. Okay, so I should probably finish. There's others. Okay. Well, I really want to ask some people about this. So let me just try. And then you can cut me off. Okay, so if we ask, what anti-symmetric wave functions can you evaluate in polynomial time? Okay, how do I, then this is a rather interesting thing. The anti-symmetrizer, of course, has n factorial things to it. And so you think it's a very complicated operation. But we all know that the determinant is very efficiently evaluated. There's another thing which is efficiently evaluated, which is related to a Pfaffian, which we call the AGP state in chemistry. But you can ask, are there other kinds of states like this? Is that really it? And if you simply take functions, two particle functions which are anti-symmetric, and then multiply them together where the indices are repeated, then you can convince yourself quite quickly that the final object itself is anti-symmetric. Okay. So now, it turns out that this is essentially the first quantized form of a class of correlated product states. But this is not really what I wanted to say. What I wanted to ask people is the following, because we know something very strange. If I ask when can I write an n-particle function as a product of anti-symmetric m-particle functions, well, if those m-particle functions were two-particle functions, you can always do it. But if you think about something like this, where I take a four-particle wave function, I write as a product of three-particle wave functions, and these are each anti-symmetric, when you multiply them all together, you actually get a symmetric function at the end. And so you can then try and draw a plot where you say, okay, let me draw n particle states wave functions, and I'm going to consider when I can represent them as products of m-particle anti-symmetric functions and draw a dot, and you get something like this. And clearly it has some fractal structure. So the question is this just numerology? So I don't know. This might be a good conference to ask people about this kind of thing. And we can talk more about that. Okay, so there are other things we can do. And let me just go to the end. So one can have a lot of fun with wave functions. That's really the central message of the talk. And I'm very optimistic. I mean, a strongly correlated problem in quantum chemistry and also in condensed matter has a long time been viewed as sort of maybe an even insoluble problem. But I think there's a lot of new understanding coming from many different communities that if you know mathematically how to express locality, then really these simulations are really feasible. And so with that, I think I'll stop. This is my group. And Hitesh is here, as well as Claire. And this is what the people work on. And I should thank these agencies for funding. Thank you for your attention.